My name is Elizabeth Evans, and I'm a homeschooling mom to four kids, ages 2 through 9, and we are learning how to make joy normal.
My name is Bonnie Landry, and I want to welcome you to season 2 of our podcast, Make Joy Normal. We want to thank everybody for their support and how much you've shared this podcast with your friends and those who you think it would be helpful for. I am a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a grandma. I've been homeschooling for 30 years. My kids are ages 14 to 33. I only have one at home now. I'm a speaker, a writer, a blogger, and I guess we're podcasters now, Elizabeth. And I'm an advocate of joy, so welcome to our podcast.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Bonnie.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Me too. So just to give our people some context, after our last episode on obedience that was published last Saturday, we've had a host of questions come in about specific things. And so Christina's kind of compiled them into sort of like categories. So we're going to get through as many as we can today. And we've just been commenting to each other that each one of these could be an episode on its own, but that we'll start here and sort of see where we go with it and see how far we get. We might get stuck on the first question.
Yeah. All right. Well, the first set sort of category of question all has to do with counter will. So basically just resistance from a child, resisting our agenda.
Right.
And so I'll just use this one question as sort of an example, but I think this could have, I mean, I'm sure everyone, every parent understands this. My son is 7 and as loving and helpful as he can be, most of our days are peppered with resistance. This is delivered in whining and yelling. No, 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 and no, no, I'm not going to do it. And it could be pick up my cars, do math, compromise on a show with my sisters, share my toys, etc. So I don't want to focus on the pick up my cars because I have a whole other section on helping around the house.
Okay,
but just that no.
Right.
What do we do with that? Especially, I mean, obviously it's hard with a younger child, but when they start to get older and they are more capable of self-control and a little bit more impulse control, how do we deal with the resistance like that?
Okay. So I think it's really important to note right from the outset that when your child does that, there's nothing wrong with them. Okay. That's normal.
That's
developmental
normal, yeah.
Behavior. Yeah. And so, you know, of course we need to learn as parents, we need to learn management skills within that because they can't just say no and that's the end of the story, you know, or you can't just get a fight with them and interfere with them every time they say no, but that this is a really clear developmental stage, you know, the idea of counter will, and some kids are much more difficult. They're much more obstinate about their counter will. Some kids are much more malleable, but it exists in all kids. And we have to, if we know it's normal, I think that helps us to cope with it and not think this kid is a psychopath. This kid's going to end up in jail. You know, this kid's never going to get a job because he won't listen to his boss. You know, that's not true. And so, I think one of the things that first pops into my mind when we're talking about this is actually reducing the amount of things to say no to. Now, we can't reduce that to nothing, and that wouldn't even be healthy for us or our children.
Right.
But first of all, if we pose something as a question, it's like we're giving them an option. Okay.
Do you
want to pick up the toys now? No. Do you want to get dressed now? No. Right? So let's not pose it as a question because it's non-negotiable. When we pose something as a question, we have to assume, if somebody asks us a question as adults, we have to assume that they're giving us an option, right? Yes, I want to put my clothes on. No, I don't.
Yeah, that's
and
a
really,
very good point.
That's not what we're doing. If you're giving them an option, that's different, right? Would you like Rice Krispies or Chex, right? You're giving them an option. Or would you like breakfast now or later? Or whatever, you know, whatever we're giving them an option about. If you're not asking them an option, it's not a soft sell to give them, you know, would you like to put your clothes on now? If you know darn well, now is the time that the clothes are going on. Don't ask it as a question, okay? So it's time to put our clothes on. They might still respond with no. And it's okay for us to say, actually, no is not one of the options here. You know, now is the time we put our clothes on. And yeah, we're just going to put our clothes on. And so depending on the age of the child and the, you know, level of counterwill you're experiencing or the level of obstinacy, that we just do it. Right. We just, you know, if they're three or two and you're and you say, oh, we have to put your clothes on now. Don't necessarily expect them. Some kids at two or three are going to just happily put their clothes on when you ask them to. But if they say no, then we just put the child on our lap, put their pants on, put their shirt on, and end of the story. And so we don't have to play with that. We don't have to, being gentle doesn't mean trying to talk them into it. And I think that's one of the, certainly for me, that was a big idea to get around with the idea of gentle parenting, was that it was more of a conversation, or that I could logic the child into, you know, the reasons why we put our clothes on. And sometimes you can do that, but I think we just have to be the grown up. And this is the thing we're doing now. You know, what's important is we don't get angry, right? So even if it's a matter of we've asked them once, maybe twice, but usually once is, you know, the better option, because then they know, okay, I might as well just put my clothes on, because I'm going to just end up on your lap with my clothes getting put on while I thrash, right? And so, and you, in the long run, you just end up getting a lot less thrashing by doing it.
Well, and I've been thinking a lot about this idea, because I have a very, you know, I've got a 3.5-year-old, so I'm drowning in counter will. And I've been following Flourishing Homes and Families on Instagram for a while, and she posted some things recently that were so helpful to me. One of them was to look at obedience as a collaborative thing. So you're really trying to help your child cooperate with you, but in a, like, I know this person loves me and I trust them, and so I'm going to work with them because they want, you know, they want what's best for me. And the way that the child learns that is you say, you know, instead of do this right now or punishment will happen, you say, okay, we have this problem. I need you, you need to do your math today. You're saying you don't want to do math. How can we solve it together? You know, right. What are some ideas that you have about how we could solve this problem?
Yeah, with an older child, such a good tool, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that's, even with my 3.5-year-old, that has been really helpful, because he has ideas sometimes of ways that he thinks to solve the problem. Now, sometimes they're ridiculous, like, you know, when it comes to, maybe we could put my baby brother on the roof, and then you and I could play the thing I want to play and not worry about him getting in the way. Well, that's not an option, so let's think about some other things, you know. But that works so much better, and it keeps me, I'm so much more regulated and happier, and everything goes better if I do that instead of snapping into, you're the kid, I'm the adult, you do what I say, period.
Yeah. Mode. Yeah. And even capitalizing on his idea, like saying, well, actually the roof wouldn't be safe, but for a little while I could put him on my back in the carrier and we could play a game and he'd be out of our way. That he might last 15 or 20 minutes if we did that, you know? And so you're using his idea, but you're just, you know, not putting the baby on the roof. Yeah. And also I think sometimes in problem solving, we can say things like, I wonder what would happen if we put the baby on the roof.
You're so really good at asking those questions.
I know. I wonder what would happen. That might be unsafe, you know, or whatever. See what he comes up with. Cause you know, he's just thinking whatever comes into his head without thinking through any consequences.
Yeah, exactly. 3.5.
But to focus on the older child and the math thing for a moment, that I think, I don't know how old the child is. Sorry, did it say how old the child was?
7.
Right. So one of the things that I feel is really important is that we recognize that, A, in order to keep learning to be a lovely thing, right, that learning is a good thing in our homes, and that we don't stress the child out with a thing, that sometimes we can just a matter of sitting with them, right? Or even if not sitting with them, making sure they know we're available if they get to a point there where they're tripping up is really helpful. And so sometimes to go back, say the child is, say they're quite capable of doing their math, right? But they're balking at it, okay? That sometimes we can say, you know, for whatever reason, maybe they're in a bad mood, maybe they're tired, maybe they stayed up late, maybe whatever, we don't know. That sometimes it's an okay day to say, you know what, I think you seem like it's going to be hard to concentrate today, right? And we make that a gift to them, right? We're not going to do math today because I can see that you're struggling, right? That we, you know, in earnest, we care about how this goes down. But, of course, we can't do that every day because we have to do some math. But we could say in the problem solving, you know, would it help if I was sitting with you? And we were talking about the questions as you did them. So do less questions sitting with them. And there's often way more value in the doing less and sitting with than there is doing 30 and not sitting with, right? And so, you know, we might think, okay, well, how can I possibly do that? I've got, you know, 7 kids and I can't, you know, I can't sit with you. But if you were to say, okay, this is going to be a 10-minute project and let's see how that goes. Let's try that for a couple of weeks. Or a week, and let's see how that goes. If I sit with you, is that easier to do your math because you're not getting stuck on a question or you're not getting distracted by the other kids playing or whatever's, you know, going on? Maybe that's a way we can just do this. And then the child feels heard, they feel seen, they feel cared for. And, you know, it just becomes one of the tools in our toolbox that, and they might say at some point, actually, this, I don't think I need you sitting with me anymore. And they might say, you might actually see them progress much more quickly in math because you make that option available to them, right? Or that you just, you know, okay, I'm going to be loading the dishwasher, but if you call me and I need you to help, I'll just drop what I'm doing and come. Okay. So, you know, I'm available to you if you need me, but I would actually start with sitting because sometimes you can get to the root of why they're balking at the math just by attending, right?
Mm-hmm. Because there might be something that they just can't articulate or they're nervous about or they're
just having a hard time focusing like la, la, yeah. La, you know, this is hard to focus on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I see that a lot. Sense.
Okay. Anything else on that topic? I love that advice about not asking them what they want unless you really want to know what they want.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because kids a lot of times don't know what they want. And they certainly don't know what they need.
Here's this little classic scenario that I think happens to every parent in every situation where you're trying to get ready to go in the car. And we tend to get ramped up as adults, you know, getting ready. So, just consider managing the environment, which I talk about a lot for just a moment, that if we say, okay, we have to be somewhere in the morning and the kids immediately, as soon as you ramp up, the kids start pushing back, right? We all recognize that even from our tiny little toddlers. Yeah. Or the baby starts crying or needs to nurse or whatever, because we start ramping up. So if we kind of get ahead of the game, right, where, okay, everybody's clothes and shoes are going to be laid out the night before. Whether you do it or the kids do it or whatever, or your husband does it, you know, that we know, okay, when we get up in the morning, we know where everybody's shoes and clothes are, right? Or bag of stuff that they need to take with them or whatever it is, that we prepare the night before. And then it's not one of these situations that you get into is like you're looking for somebody's socks or you're looking for somebody's pants. And so it's kids causing you to ramp up more and therefore causing more pushback with your kids. If we can stay calm, we're going to get less counter will than, or less really obstinate counter will than we would otherwise. And so say there's 3 kids that all are, you know, fussing about, so you have to dress the baby and we're hoping the toddler just put clothes on. It's just way faster just to grab that toddler, allow yourself that extra buffer of time, stay calm, put the toddler's clothes on and then put them in the car. If you're trying to get them to get shoes on, again, you know, shoes on. We're often saying, get your shoes on. And if we just throw their shoes in the car,
that's what I do.
Car seat, and then put their shoes on, they can't even take them off, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those situations where managing environment, we can't get rid of counter will. It's a developmental stage. We can reduce the impact on our lives by our making sure that we keep ourselves calm, by making sure that we aren't having things in our life that create more angst, and by managing the environment a little better, right? And so those are things that I think all kind of play into this, you know, and be playful with the kids as you're getting them ready, you know, be playful, right? You know, reminding them where we're going, you know, just being silly, you know, just to remind yourself that, okay, you know, especially going to church, right? You know, be happy. We don't want to be yelling at our kids as we go out to church. And, you know, many of us, including myself, find ourselves in that situation. We have little kids like, I just want to get out the door. And so if we can, you know, remember what this is all about, you know, we're going to be much better off. So those are just some sort of general thoughts.
Yeah.
If you want to pull out any more specific things, I'd be happy to address things that, you know, tools we used or tactics we use.
I think that's good for that topic because okay. The next topic is connected, not sibling dynamics, because right. There's a lot of counter will involved in there. So same 7-year-old hits his sisters who are 3 and 5, and then they hit back, and then there's this vicious circle. And it infuriates, this mom says, it upsets and infuriates me. These are the moments when I lose my peace and yell. Right. And I just don't know what to do or say in the moment to stay calm and address everyone's behavior, injuries, hurt feelings, etc. And then tagging along with that is another mom who has a 5-year-old daughter who has big emotions and gets frustrated really easily, especially with her younger brother. When that happens, she tends to grab him by the neck and squeeze him very tightly. How can I deal with this behavior without threatening or yelling at her? So very similar.
Yeah, I think that, these are great questions. Sibling thing is hard. Like it's just hard. It's hard. You get discouraged, right? When you see your siblings, yeah. You know, fighting with each other. One of the things that I think is important is that right away we make a statement about the behavior, right? That, you know, is coupled with or immediately followed up with a redirection of some sort. So the statement being, we don't do that. That hurts him. You must move over here. You know, that's, I'm going to put myself in between you two right now. You know, that we make a statement, you know, that can cause damage. You know, that's, we don't do that in our family. You know, whatever the thing is, you know, we can sort of, but it's helpful to think of a few things to say, because we often get tongue-tied when we're frustrated, right? And, you know, that's when we got, you know, and the yelling comes out. But if we can have a few things like, we don't do that, right? We don't do that in this house. You know, you may not handle your sister that way, right? So we're not saying, you know, you're bad or you're, you know, right, you're right. Whatever, but, and we're not even saying you're hurting him. We're just, that's unacceptable behavior. That was something I said a lot. That's unacceptable. We don't do that in our house, right? Those were two phrases that I just, because the first thing that wants to come out of my mouth is to yell.
Yeah.
And so if I can have a phrase that I think, okay, this is my phrase I'm going to use. So the more kind of universal it can be, like, we don't do that in this house, or that's not acceptable. And I mean, that can, there can be a big range of things that you respond in that way. Say, for example, you know, potty humor is getting to you, or the child is, you know, picking their nose or whatever, right? That we just, you know, things that we don't want them to do and we're trying to train them not to do, that we just say, yeah, not acceptable. We don't do that here. Why wipe your hands? Blah, blah, blah. You know, off you go. So it's not a judgment. It's just stating that, yeah, not here. It's not what we do. And so that's really helpful when there's, you know, stuff happening between kids. I mean, we have to actually physically respond to that as well. So in that situation, if there's hitting happening or choking happening or whatever, that hurts him, and you actually put, you know,
remove them, yeah.
Put the child up and say, you need to stand here. I need to keep people safe. That's my job. Right. But get in.
I say that a lot.
Yeah, get in between the actions so that, you know, you physically aren't going to do that. But one, the other sort of thing we need to do is preempt those situations, right? And again, this is a managing the environment situation where we assume that if we leave them playing and in within 5 or 10 minutes, there's usually a fight going on. Don't leave them playing, right? Have them playing in separate areas. If you have something else you have to be doing, you know, set you up with Lego, set you up with a snack, right? That we, or take one with you, right? So whatever you're doing, say you're going to, you have to make supper or you have to go change the baby, take one of the, you know, children who tend to fight with you. You know, oh, help, come and help me change the baby. You know, you hand me the wipes or whatever, so that you're not leaving the two or three that are causing problems together, right? And they are going to grow out of this. It's not going to be, and they're not going to, you know, the 17-year-old isn't going to choke the 14-year-old in most cases, right? And so if we can avoid as much as possible having them end up in that situation, when we do, this is how we can respond. But if we can avoid it as much as possible, that's a really good way of managing the environment.
Well, that right? has been, I mean, I think we want to be able to leave our baby and 3.5-year-old alone in the playroom and just trust that they're going to be fine. But it's not reasonable. And I think a lot of people feel like there's something wrong with their kids if they can't leave them unsupervised. At those young ages, and just trust that they're not going to be at each other's throats, sometimes literally. But it's really not reasonable to expect that. They don't have impulse control.
It's not. They're impulse driven. Yeah. And so, you know, especially one of the hard parts about parenting is those years when we only have little kids, which you're in the thick of right now, and seeing that kids grow out of these things, right? And that's hard because we, wherever we're at in our journey as human beings, I think our tendency is to think,
never gonna
okay, this is it. This is my life for the rest of my life, you know, and for all eternity, I am going to be pulling the 3.5-year-old off the 1-year-old, right? And that's how it feels. And that's not reality, but until you actually have older kids, you don't really know what that's like to kind of have them grow out of that and experiencing that and being able to turn your back and know that, you know, they're not going to be laying flat on top of their brother or, you know, giving them things they can choke on or whatever, whatever is the thing is we're experiencing. So remembering that little kids are impulse driven and we cannot, even if they seem on most days, they're trustworthy or whatever, a 5-year-old, you know, can't be left alone with a 2-year-old without, yeah, I mean, some, you can walk out of the room sometimes, you know, your kid's better than anybody else does, but you should always be within earshot because we don't really know what they're capable of. Right. And, you know, so, I mean, and there's another thing is like, if you keep them within earshot, if you feel like, okay, they're getting to that stage where I can leave them on their own and they, you know, playing well together and that's really good. You know, you want to have some kind of, whether that's a baby monitor on in the room they're playing in and start to, you know, notice if things are heating up or if it means that you're actually sitting in the room sometimes when they're, you know, if you're or nearby, you're nursing the baby and you can't be right there. So at least be, you know, have a visual or have a audio on it at all times that, you know, that idea that I've talked about a lot, the idea of containing our kids, like having your living space where your kids are, be very small so that you are aware of where they are and you can hear the things that are going on, you have less to keep clean.
I have a couple of things to add that have just been really helpful for me at this stage because I am in that only little kid stage. And I read this book called Peaceful Parents, Happy Siblings by Laura Markham. And it was so helpful to me, especially in the early days when Nico had just been born and Joseph was really struggling. But it's continued to help. And one of the things that helps is that she talks about how when you see one of your children hurting another child, it immediately triggers your amygdala, the part of your brain, the fight or flight part of your brain, and your primitive brain is telling you this child is going to kill the other child. Like that, it feels like an emergency to you because your brain is interpreting it as an emergency, your primitive brain. That's when you have to get into your prefrontal cortex, your reasoning brain, and look at the situation and say, no one is dying. No one is killing anybody else. Everyone is reasonably safe right now. And if you can say that to yourself and take a few deep breaths before going in and breaking up the kids, then you're going to be much less likely to yell and or get really just angry and stern with the child who hurt the other child, because again, mm-hmm. they're usually completely impulse driven and not trying to do it. You know, they're not doing, I mean, a lot of times Joseph doesn't even realize how strong he is, and he's just playing, and all of a sudden it turns into something that could hurt his brother. Or, you know, he doesn't realize that, like, putting a leash around Nico's neck of, you know, using one of my bathrobe sashes as a leash, that that's actually really dangerous. But my brain totally made up. My brain immediately goes to, oh my gosh, my child is dying. But that's not actually what's happening. Like, in times past, there might have been moments, you know, like there are times when your child is in mortal danger, and it's good that your brain gives you that signal that, to like rush into action. But these are not those times. And I think to know that your brain is mm-hmm. still going to react that way, and so you have to talk yourself out of that emergency response, it really helps me when I actually remember to do it. I don't always do it,
yeah,
but
really
it does
nice.
Help when it, when I remember.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's helped me is to remember that if I do leave my two sons alone, even for a few minutes, and the baby ends up getting hurt or crying, I apologize to the baby because that was my bad. I really should not. I put Joseph in a situation where he basically, like, I was basically baiting him. I mean, I gave him, lead me down to temptation. I led him right down the primrose path of temptation by leaving that little baby in there with him. And so I've started to apologize. You know, that was mommy's fault. It was my job to keep you both safe, and I didn't do a very good job. I'm so sorry. After I tell Joseph, it's not okay to do X, Y, Z. And also just not addressing, you know, not addressing the issue right then and there, especially if I'm all keyed up. I take the baby away. I comfort the baby. And then later I go to Joseph and I say, you know, when you did X, Y, Z, that was not okay. What can we do next time if Nico takes one of your toys? And he'll talk with me about it. Now, he doesn't always remember to call me instead of pushing him out of the way. But sometimes he does, and he needs a lot of practice. So he's getting a lot of practice. And those are some of the things that have helped me. And this is my biggest trigger is one child hurting another child. And I think that's many moms, that's the case, because we really do have this instinctual reaction to it.
I think so. And even, you know, when they get into older years and teen years and stuff like that, if they're being hurtful to each other, like saying hurtful things or whatever, that's a real trigger too, right? And it almost is the same response as when they're young. You know, you see two, you know, teenage boys going at it or something like that verbally, and you think, oh, it's so hurtful. You know, why would they be hurtful? You know, and yeah, it's something that can trigger really fast, I've found. And one of the things that was helpful for me, obviously deep breaths, taking, if you can take a deep breath or whatever, or say a little prayer before you know, it prevents you from launching, right? Because that's what we want to do, is just, and if we can prevent ourselves from doing that, one of the little phrases in my brain that I would use is, don't make it worse.
I love that
if I
one.
Can, yeah, if I can try not to make this worse, what can I do? Now, sometimes you do something you think is not going to make it worse, and it does make it worse, right? But if that's what you're thinking, is how can I not make this worse? Because it's a guarantee if you yell or whatever, it's going to make it worse. That's a guarantee.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And even just overreacting, because that's the thing, is that most of the time, this is not a serious issue. It's not a life-threatening issue. It's just your brain reacting. Feels like it is. And so if you overreact and shame your child, which I've definitely gone down that path with my older one, because I'm so dysregulated emotionally seeing my baby get hurt, that, you know, it can cause a lot of distress in the older child, because they didn't mean to do it. They didn't think about it. They weren't premeditating it. And even if when they get older and they can actually reason and have a little bit more impulse control, they're still so young and they're still human and they're going to make mistakes, and shaming them is not going to help them love their sibling more. That's the other thing I learned from that book, is that the more you bring the other sibling into it and say, look what you did to him, look how much you hurt him, you know, you need to say I'm sorry right now.
Yeah, it just causes friction between the siblings.
It just
right?
makes it worse between the two siblings.
What's the name of the book again? I'll put it in the show notes.
Peaceful Parent, Happy Siblings.
Okay, yes, I've seen this.
She also wrote Peaceful Parent, Happy Child.
Yeah.
Which is a similar, but basically the premise of the book is that you are the one who's responsible for your own emotions and your own reactions, and you got to get that straight because your children are immature and they cannot be held responsible in the same way for their actions and their emotions. So
it's basically human being, how to learn to be a human being.
Yes.
How to be you're in charge. You're in charge of your own emotions.
Yeah. So great book. Highly recommend it, especially if you're expecting your second child. I wish I had read it while I was pregnant. I did read it pretty much very soon after I had my second. But I wish I'd read it while I was pregnant. It would have been, because there's a whole section on how to prepare your oldest child for a sibling in a really respectful way, which I found is very helpful.
You know, and every time a new child comes into the family, there's this shift in the siblings, right? And there can be sort of alliances that you were unexpected, you know, that. And I mean that in a good way, like the 8-year-old suddenly sort of sees that the 3-year-old's feeling a little displaced and they kind of take them under their wing a little bit. So you can see these lovely alliances happen. But you can also see shifts happen that are negative too, right? That, you know, people are, fighting, and, you know, there's just a shift that happens. And I mean, I feel like in our family, the welcoming of a new baby went really smoothly. But there is a shift that happens, and it's just something that you kind of notice. And sometimes it can mean more squabbling. Sometimes it can mean more peacefulness, right? But we have to expect that there's going to be a shift, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's really helpful, yeah.
All right. Do we have time for one more?
I think so, yeah. We've got 20 minutes or so.
All right. So this one is about helping around the house, specifically toy cleanup.
Okay.
And she kind of answers her own question, but I think there's a lot of wisdom that we could get from you on this subject. And it's something that I'm currently learning how to handle as well. So what's the gentle parenting response to a 6-year-old not picking up his toys? He dumped out 4 bins of Lincoln Logs, train toys, magnet tiles, and castle blocks, and then didn't want to put them away before we were getting ready for bed.
Right.
He said he was hungry and tired, and I'm sure he felt overwhelmed by all the toys. Maybe it would have been better to get only one bin out, but I wasn't around when he did it. I know I should have also sat down with him to clean it up, but I was doing dishes and other bedtime stuff. We're bad about threatening that toys will go into timeout or toy jail, which I hate saying, and I don't want to punish his brother by putting away the toys. I do try to simplify and declutter our toys, but it seems like we've had a consistently difficult time trying to have him clean up the toys, even when we're on the floor cleaning with him or when we put on cleanup music.
Right. Yeah. I mean, simplifying it obviously is the number one thing we can do there. I think that if you are aware that a child is hungry and tired, even if you know retrospectively, like, okay, that kind of crashed and burned because I think they were tired and hungry. It's not an ideal time to ask a child to do anything, really. I mean, even, you know, how, like, when you're, potty training kids or whatever, or you're something, they just normal developmental stuff. On a normal day, it just is fine. But on a day that they're tired and, you know, or something has happened and they're just, you know, there's an upset of some sort, or they're just out of their normal routine, those things become a lot harder to convince them to do, right? Even like, it's time for your bedtime story. You know, if they're already overtired, sometimes they're like, no, I don't want my bedtime story, when there's this big, you know, hoo-ha over simple things, right? Or you can't get a hungry child to eat sometimes, right? Because they're past the point of no return. And so it's something I think that we have to be sensitive to, that if we're going to ask them things of them, first of all, you know, the whole idea of the connect before you direct, right? So pull them up on your lap, you know, hi, sweetheart, how are you doing? We had a really fun day today. Look at this mess means there must have been a lot of fun happening here today. And what do you think we're going to do about this mess? And, you know, a little connection, a little before you ask them to do something. So that's always a good idea, no matter what you ask them. It's just really, in a sense, good manners with human beings to kind of work on the relationship just for a second or two before you ask something of somebody, right? Just provide connection, provide context for what's going on. And it's just something that's very easy to train yourself to do. And it was made probably the most massive difference in my life in terms of asking my kids to do stuff. It was just, you know, having kind of a friendly attitude, you know, and chit-chatting with them, and then say, you know, okay, we need to clean up now or whatever. I think in this situation, it's one of those things that if we can have those bins, if we have a high cupboard where we keep them and we only pull out one at a time, that the easiest thing we can do is just to say, when those are all put away, then you can have the X out. Right. So chances are pretty good that they're probably not playing with the Lincoln Logs and the Legos and the Magnetiles all at one time. And so it's more enjoyable for them, in a sense. Kids like order. And even if they're sort of like reveling in the mess at the moment, they do like order. And so if we just kind of get in the habit that maybe there's one or two things out, you know, okay, well, let's put that away now. And then we'll get the other thing out. This is extreme, but I'm going to mention it anyway, because I have a friend who did this. And when I first observed this, I thought, wow, that's intense. It wouldn't be what I would do, but boy, did it work. And she had a different Rubbermaid container for every day of the week, one Rubbermaid container, and there was toys in that Rubbermaid container. And at the end of Monday, everything got put in the Monday box, it got put out in the garage, and one of the older kids got the Tuesday box.
Wow. Right?
And so here's, I mean, I love seeing my kids have giant Playmobil setups and giant Lego setups. And we have a room sort of dedicated to that kind of thing, because as they got older, not little kids, but as they got older, it was so cool to see the creativity that came out of that. So, but I can see the logic in this and the wisdom in this, that her kids got used to, like, oh, the Monday box, yay, because there's certain things in the Monday box that they don't have any other time of the week, only on Mondays. And so there's still a kind of a creative, interesting, fun thing to do with the Monday box, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, do kids really need more than one Rubbermaid full of toys, one Rubbermaid container full of toys on any given day? And maybe there's Legos in the Monday box, and maybe there's Lincoln Logs in the Tuesday box. And, you know, so we have had option. We can be that restrictive with our kids and not deny them a rich learning environment, right?
Yeah.
A rich play environment. And in some ways might even encourage them to play with things around the house, you know, getting the plastics drawer and going outside and playing in the dirt or whatever. You know, there's a lot of, I think there's wisdom in it. So I think there's wisdom also in just having one of those things out at a time. And so even though they might whine about that, but no, I want Magnetiles and I don't want to put this away. Oh yeah, well that's hard. But when this is away, I'll bring the Magnetiles out. And we can just be nice about it. And they might have a giant hissy fit. They might throw themselves on the floor, but that's okay. They're going to survive that. As long as you keep your cool. Yeah, that's too bad. Well, let me know when you're ready to clean up and I'll help you. But let me know when you're ready. And, you know, they might lose interest in the Magnetiles and just keep on playing with the Lincoln Logs. That might be one of the possibilities, right? So when we think about when we ask kids to go back to the sort of tired and hungry aspect of this, when we ask kids to do things, it might be a good idea to do it before dinner. And you know what? Actually, we're not going to bring that out before dinner because it's too hard to clean up afterwards and it makes bedtime harder. So we're going to do a before dinner cleanup, and then we're going to, you know, just read a story after dinner or whatever. Right. So
for us, what has helped is limiting the number of toys available. I noticed that whenever the Mega Blocks were out, We have this big bin of Mega Blocks, and the boys love playing with them. But recently, the only thing that they had been doing is just dumping the whole box out, the whole bin, and just scattering them all to the four winds. And it was getting so frustrating to me that I just put them all in the bin and put them up on the highest shelf. And it has been a few days since they've been out. First of all, they haven't asked. Joseph hasn't asked for them. Secondly, the cleanup has been 5 million times easier. And they're not suffering, like, just because they don't have Mega Blocks right now. And, you know, we'll probably take them out again sometime. Or maybe we'll just pass them along. But I don't know.
It's not ruining their life, right?
It's not ruining their life. And I think one of the things I learned, one of the things that struck me in Hunt Gather Parent was, you know, the idea that kids need these toys to have a fulfilled childhood is very new. And we really overestimate, I think, how many toys our kids need. And it is nice to have lots of options for building things and using, you know, being creative. But before all these toys existed, little kids played with rocks and sticks.
In a sense, rob them from the opportunity to be creative in that way.
Yes.
If they have too much, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And of course, we want things when the weather's bad or for, you know, quiet activity to do or whatever. But I think we really overdo it. One of the toys that, or, you know, things that, activities that my kids spent most of their time doing was the wooden blocks, was a big deal when they were little, and dress-up clothes. And dress-up clothes were just magical. My kids spent so much time just dressing up. I wanted to mention one more thing about cleanup, which is a friend of mine did this years ago. Her kids were a little bit older than mine, so they were probably between about, say, 4 and 10. And she had this system called a Saturday box. And so if the kids didn't pick up after themselves, whatever, whether it was clothes or shoes or toys or whatever, there was a box, kind of a high box in the corner of the, you know, closet or something like that, called the Saturday box. And she would just go around and pick the things up and put them in the Saturday box. And if they said, but where's my such and such? She said, oh, well, it's in the Saturday box. And they wouldn't bring it out until Saturday. And then it would get dumped in the middle of the living room floor, and everything had to be put away before they were, you know, able to go on and play with the stuff. They had to put their clothes away and whatever. But it was kind of a collaborative thing. Like, I'm going to do this with you. We're going to dump the Saturday box together. We're going to put the things away that didn't get put
away.
That's
a good idea.
It's a really good idea. And so, and it was also not just about toys. It was about, you know, the stuff you left laying around, which can really accumulate in our life as well. And so, oh yeah, that's too bad. It's in the Saturday box. And it was a gentle thing, you know, and then it was, they just grew up with this idea that, oh, okay, it's in the Saturday box, so there's no point in bugging about it because I'm not going to get it. Just on the sibling, sorry, go ahead. On the sibling topic too, that my little kids often squabble about a thing. Right. And one of the things that we always did is I would just say, oh, yeah, that will, if we're going to fight it, we're just going to put that thing away because that's causing too many problems. And so we'd put, so my husband would know what kind of day we had based on how much stuff was on top of the fridge. But we don't have to, but we don't have to be mean about it either, or yell or whatever. You know, we can just be matter of fact, oh, that's just causing way too many problems. That goes up here. And, you know, we can say, I'm going to take that away. I'm going to take that away, and sort of harp about it. Or we can just put it away. Yeah. You know, and again, their hissy fit might ensue, but that's okay. They'll survive.
Well, and I just, something else that I've read in books about boys specifically with toys, they get very overwhelmed. I don't know if girls, this probably happens to little girls too, but boys get so visually overwhelmed by the number of toys. It looks like an impossible task to them, especially if there's a lot of stuff out.
Yeah.
So asking them to pick up a specific number of things
or color, or something like that,
that helps a lot. Because Joseph is really interested in counting right now because he's just starting to learn. And that has been really, really helpful. Also, making it into a game has been really helpful too. Like, let's see how many I can get versus how many you can get. I bet you can't get more than I can.
Or can you toss them in the basket?
Yeah. Joseph loves that. But the other thing really has been just doing it as a family and not making it a, you have to do this because you made a mess. But we're all going to do this together because we're all part of a team and we're all a family and we're all going to clean up. And yes, that means that sometimes we have to wash the dishes a little bit later or rearrange some of our bedtime or evening routine. But I found that the peace that comes with not having to fight about it mm-hmm. and not having to nag and then not ending up just doing all the cleanup by myself after the boys are in bed.
Yeah.
It's just invaluable. It's so much better for me in my mind. It's so much better to do it all as a family, even if that means kind of the flow of the bedtime routine is not as smooth as I would like it to be.
Yeah.
Because I'm helping. It's so much better than trying to make them do it themselves.
I think it's a really good comparison to when you're sitting with your child, going back to the math thing, when you're sitting with your child homeschooling, rather than saying, you do this thing, I'm doing this thing, you do this thing, that when we do things alongside our kids, they're much more pleasant. We can actually make it a point of connection in the day rather than a point of disruption. You know, it doesn't have to be that every time we ask our kids to tidy up, it's a point of disruption. We don't have to make all the schoolwork they do points of disruption. Get it done, get it done, get it done. Those can be points of connection. And but we have to rethink what we're doing in order to make that points of connection rather than disruption.
And so often for me, I realize the disruption comes because I have a plan. I have an agenda in my mind. And I'm seeing my children's needs as somehow in competition with that or an interruption to this plan, whether it's for dinner or cleaning or whatever I'm doing around the house. Or maybe I'm just scrolling my phone and they need me. And when I see them as my primary, they're not interrupting me, but these other things are ancillary. Yeah. These other things are ancillary to their needs. That's when I have a good day with them. It's when I'm constantly trying to do my own thing or like sneaking in my own thing while, you know, trying to balance.
They're busy. I'm going to send this text or send this email or whatever.
That's when things go haywire. But when I accept that, you know what, this means that dinner is going to be a little later tonight, or this means that I'm not going to have a perfectly clean kitchen when my husband gets home from work. But he understands, and it's fine, because their needs are more important than a perfectly clean kitchen.
And it's such a short season, right?
Yes. It
feels long, but it's actually short.
And that is something I remind myself of all the time, is that they're not going to be this little forever.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Do you have time for one more, or do you want to stop?
Do you think it looks like a quick one? Because we probably have time for a short one, or we could wait until...
It's not a short one. I don't think the response will be short. So let's save it.
Okay. Do you want to say it's what
about
it is
bedtime,
so we can start with it next week? Okay. Yeah, that's kind
and
of
kids sleeping in their own bed. This is wanting to come and sleep with you.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of a big...
I figured you'd want to do a pull-up.
Okay, but at least we know what we're getting into for next week.
Yes, yes.
Okay, sounds good. How about we wrap up there then, and we'll chat next week. God bless.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, Bonnie. Bye.